Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome students here with us today. We have West Bend High School students. Would they stand, please? Good seeing you all. You may be seated. And we have the Wisconsin Career Academy students. You may stand, please. It's good having you here today. You may be seated. And we have students from Edgewood College. They may stand. Good. We're delighted to see you, Mr. Moser. Please be seated. The students are here with us under a variety of programs. The high school students are here with the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program in which we invite high school students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they join us, they are given briefs of the case that they will hear. They may engage in outside activities about this case, and they come to oral argument. If they come in the morning, they usually meet with a justice, and the West Bend High School students did that. I am going to meet with the Edgewood College students right after this oral argument, and I'm sure that the Edgewood College students will not object if we invite the Wisconsin Career Academy students to join with us if they can under their time constraints. And this has been a very, very successful program with literally thousands of students from colleges and across the state, high schools, and even middle schools. So we're delighted that you could all come. The discussion is about the procedures of the court, not about the substantive issues involved in the cases. Does anyone here need a summary of the case we are about to hear? If so, the marshal has one, the deputy marshal has one, and we'll distribute it. Anyone want a summary of the case? Let me introduce the court to you all now that we've met some of you at least. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and to her left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call our first case. 07AP105CR, State versus Jeffrey A. Belton, and Paul G., and is it Lozati or Lozat?
Lozat.
Assistant State Public Defender will argue on behalf of the defendant. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Lozat. I represent Jeffrey Warbleton. Mr. Warbleton is asking this court to vacate his six convictions. His grounds for doing so, Mr. Warbleton asserts that the circuit court judge erroneously allowed the state to present evidence to the jury that evidence that Mr. Warbleton had a previous conviction for a violent crime. And Mr. Warbleton also asserts that the circuit court erroneously instructed the jury that they were to make a finding regarding that matter. Mr. Warbleton contends that the circuit court was mistaken for two reasons. Number one, because stalking is always a crime. It's Mr. Warbleton's view that having a previous conviction for a violent crime is like the general repeater enhancer. As a second grounds, Mr. Warbleton takes the position that even if having a previous conviction for a violent crime is a substantive element, the reasoning set forth in State versus Alexander, a prohibited alcohol concentration case, is equally applicable to this case, perhaps more so. In Alexander, the defendant is guilty of driving with a prohibited alcohol concentration unless he had two or more prior convictions, suspensions, or revocations as counted under Section 343.307. In that case, the court's concern was if the state presented evidence of those prior convictions and then they were submitted to the jury might well infer that those prior convictions, suspensions, or revocations must have something to do with drunk driving. And therefore, there was a great danger that they would further conclude that the defendant before them had a propensity to drunk driving. Therefore, the court, in applying the state's rules of evidence, concluded that if a defendant was willing to admit to those prior convictions, that the state had no need to present that evidence to the jury.
Mr. Lozat, doesn't that make a lot of sense, the approach that the Court of Appeals took here? My understanding is the Court of Appeals said, Alexander's an interesting case, but it's a case that really relates only to operating while under the influence. And that this court, which was the court that ultimately decided Alexander, was concerned about the inferences that would be drawn by a jury. The inferences being, if he's got another conviction, it must be for OWI. So the Court of Appeals said that case really stands by itself. Doesn't that make a lot of sense?
It is different. However, in this particular case, if the jury's presented with evidence the defendant has a previous conviction for a violent felony, obviously the jury doesn't have to infer that the prior conviction is for a crime of violence. The jury is explicitly informed that the prior conviction is for violence. And I think there, rather than necessarily propensity to commit the crime of stalking, the danger of unfair prejudice is the likelihood of concluding, well, a violent person is more likely to engage in criminal activity than someone who is not a violent person. And I would see another danger is, for instance, in a close case, the jury having the responsibility of feeling a need to protect the complaining witness from stalking and having it weighing on their conscience, if we make a mistake and let this violent person go free this time, we acquit. We may be putting the complainant in danger as well as the larger public.
Well, didn't your client get some real benefit by his stipulation here? What was presented to the jury was certainly a sanitized version of the fact that he'd been convicted of a violent crime. If he had not entered into that stipulation, and if the state had to prove all of the information, they would have been told that that violent crime was a sexual assault. So didn't he get some real advantage by his stipulation here?
He did, Your Honor, and that was his choice. Obviously, if he had denied that he had a previous conviction for a violent crime, he had the right to say, I'm going to put the state to its proof, and it will have to prove this to the jury. In this particular instance, he didn't want to present it to the jury. He made clear to the circuit court judge, look, I'm willing to waive a jury trial on this particular issue and have the circuit court decide it. I will admit that this prior conviction exists. That's not in dispute.
Yeah, but isn't the problem that he would have the right to waive a trial on an element that the state didn't want to? And under the statute, the state doesn't have to.
Correct.
So what does the judge do? One side wants a jury trial, the other side on the element, the other side doesn't want a trial on the element, a jury trial on the element. What do you do? The compromise here was you submitted to the jury with a special verdict question, right?
Correct.
But you give the jury some limited information, right?
Correct.
So what are you supposed to do if you don't do it this way?
From my perspective, the initial ruling by the circuit court judge should have been that the prior conviction for a violent crime is not a substantive element. Therefore,
well, then you were avoiding that issue, but it'll come up in another kind of case.
And then if he concludes that it is a substantive element, I agree that the state is entitled to, under 972.02, say we're not waiving our right to a jury trial with respect to that particular element. Mm-hmm. But that's where I think the logic of the Alexander decision comes into play, where we have a situation where the defendant's willing to admit this prior conviction exists and not dispute it. So there's very limited probative value in presenting that to the jury while there is the danger of unfair prejudice. I agree that they weren't told the specific statute which he violated, which would even be, I think from a common sense perspective, even more offensive to the jury. But they were told that it was a violent felony.
Well, they had to. That was the element, if you accept it as an element.
If you accept that it's a substantive element and that it must be decided by the jury, correct.
Did the defendant waive the jury after a colloquy with the judge in open court?
Yes, my recollection of the record is when defense counsel, trial counsel, brought the issue up, the circuit court judge directly asked the defendant personally, do you agree with that approach? And the defendant said he did.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, how do you reconcile your argument with the felony in possession of a firearm statute and how those cases are tried frequently, with defendants stipulating to the second element, the jury being instructed, but the jury still has to find?
The distinction I see with respect to a crime like felon in possession of a firearm is the conduct of possessing a firearm in the state of Wisconsin is not always a crime. It's only a crime if you have a pre-existing legal status. So in that instance, if a jury was only presented with evidence that the defendant possessed a firearm, there may indeed be confusion about why are we here on a criminal case. So that's how I would see the distinction there. With respect to Mr. Warbleton, the action of stalking is always a crime. With respect to possessing a firearm, a citizen in this state is entitled to possess a firearm unless that citizen has a pre-existing legal status.
Okay. Isn't it up to the legislature, though, to decide when certain things are elements and when they're penalty enhancers or status?
It is, and in my view, they do that by the definition of the crime. For instance, with the felon in possession of a firearm, they've decided that it's only a crime if you have the pre-existing legal status. There's other statutes that are similar in nature. For instance, working in a job where you have to interact with minors who are under the age of 16. As a general rule, that's a perfectly legal occupation to have, unless you have a certain type of pre-existing conviction, which makes that illegal. And I would, another, for instance, is taking a photograph of a minor without the written consent of that minor's parent or guardian. As a general rule in a public place, that's perfectly legal. But if you're on the status of being registered as a sex offender, it's not legal. So in my view, that's how the legislature determines what the elements are. If there's no crime but for the pre-existing legal status, then the legislature has determined that the pre-existing legal status is a substantive element.
Mr. Lazat, it's my understanding that when the Court of Appeals was wrestling with this case, one of the distinctions they made was that a penalty enhancer results in the judge having some discretion as to the penalty. That in this type of situation, you don't see that discretion. Basically, when you look at this idea of the violent crime, it changes the status, if you will, of the crime from an I to an H. There's no discretion in the court. So isn't that a valid way of looking at this and trying to draw a line between on one side, penalty enhancers, and on the other side, substantive elements?
I do think the circuit court judge retains discretion in this sense. If a person is convicted of the stalking of the previous conviction, the circuit court has authority to impose up to a 6-year bifurcated sentence with the 3 years initial confinement, 3 years extended supervision. However, the circuit court also retains the discretion to say this particular defendant, I think a term of probation, a withheld sentence is adequate, or, for instance, I think a 1-year county jail sentence is adequate.
But the court doesn't have any discretion as to whether it's an H or an I felony.
Correct.
So isn't that a valid way of trying to draw the line between penalty enhancer on one hand and substantive element on the other?
I have a difficult time seeing that. For instance, if somebody was convicted of burglary as a general repeater, and the state proved that up. At the time of sentencing, the judge doesn't have discretion in the sense of saying, look, you only face a maximum sentence of X. It's X plus the repeater enhancer, where the judge retains discretion is in selecting what the appropriate disposition is. In other words, if somebody's convicted of a substantive crime as a general repeater, the circuit court doesn't have to impose the repeater enhancer. And if somebody's convicted of a Class H felony, the circuit court, if in its view the appropriate disposition is a one-year county jail sentence, still retains the authority to do that.
Counsel, even if the circuit court erred in this case, why isn't the error harmless?
I think in this case, as I reviewed the convictions, he faced trial on 12 different criminal counts before the jury, and the jury did acquit him of 6 of the counts. And in my review of the evidence, I came to the conclusion that an explanation for the acquittal on the 6 counts was you could identify testimony from the complainant that refuted an element. For instance, the criminal trespass to the dwelling. The DA's own questioning of the complainant brought out the fact that, yes, he'd been living with me in that apartment. Yes, he had a key. I guess I was kind of okay with him having that key. So her own testimony, in my view, indicated that he actually did have permission to be in that dwelling. And then with respect to the bail jumping counts and the violations of an injunction, as I understood her testimony, a very reasonable view of it was the contact in those instances wasn't intentional. It was just happenstance. There were vehicles passing in different directions in the city.
Counsel, what relationship, if any, do you think the holding in the Old Chief case has in regard to the present matter?
Yeah, I think it's, since the federal rules of evidence are so similar to the state of Wisconsin's rules of evidence, and I think it's very, very instructive, and you know, the logic would equally apply.
Please expand on that.
Well, for instance, my memory serves me right, the defendant, Old Chief, was charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm. And the government in that case, the U.S. attorney wanted to get in evidence of what that prior conviction was, and it truly was
about the specific nature of
right.
The prior felon.
And it truly was an element in the sense of absent the qualifying prior conviction, Old Chief could have possessed a firearm.
Right. The felony was the element. The prior felony
right.
was the element. Would that have been a substantive element in your analysis?
Yeah, in my view, in Old Chief, it was a substantive element because if Old Chief did not have the prior conviction, for instance, if he had no record whatsoever, then he could have possessed that firearm.
And the holding there was because the specific nature of the felony, although relevant, would have been unfairly prejudicial, therefore, the specific nature of the felony shouldn't have been discussed. It was
right. That's my understanding. He said because it is an element, it certainly is relevant evidence what his prior conviction is. But when we look at different ways of presenting that evidence, its discounted value as compared to the danger of unfair prejudice means we should keep it away. We should not let the fact finder know the name of the specific crime, or if I read it correctly, even the nature of that crime.
On the question of whether paragraph A is an element, if we were looking at 2M and then looking at E, E is the victim is under the age of 18 years at the time of the violation. Would you dispute that that's an element?
No, I would, with respect to the age of the victim being a minority, I would say that is a substantive element, a historical fact that was present during the course of conduct that would need to be proved to a jury.
Okay. Well, now let's take C. The actor intentionally gains access or causes another person to gain access to a record in electronic format. Contains personally identifiable information regarding the victim in order to facilitate the violation. Is that an element?
I see it as an element, Your Honor. And again, that being, if you look at the defined time frame of the stalking activity, that's a specific action that the state is alleging the defendant undertook within that time frame.
E is an element. C is an element. The others are a little bit more complicated to explain, but why shouldn't I conclude that A through E, all of those are elements?
Yeah. The distinction I see is with respect to paragraphs A and B, they do relate to a pre-existing legal status that can be simply satisfied with documentary evidence to a circuit court judge. With respect to paragraphs C, D, and E, each of those involves an action undertaken by the defendant as part of the stalking activity itself. And therefore, because they're part of the literal course of conduct that constitutes the stalking activity, those are substantive elements.
Does property value differ between a status element and what you call a substantive element?
I think it's much easier to come up with adequate ways of proving status beyond a reasonable doubt than it is physical actions of the defendant or state of mind of the defendant.
So what makes this actionable and the other one status?
Pardon?
What makes this actionable and the other, Alexander status?
Because my understanding of the defendant and Alexander, given the applicable statutes at that time, it was legal to drive on the highways of Wisconsin with an alcohol level of 0.08 unless you had the qualifying prior convictions. So there was no crime without those prior convictions. In this particular case, it was illegal for Mr. Warbleton to engage in stalking even if he had no prior convictions of any kind whatsoever.
I'll tell you what's bothering me about this case along with the Alexander case. You view this, and the trial court obviously viewed this as a waiver of a jury trial on an element, right?
Yeah.
Instead, the state can't be forced to waive it, right?
The substantive element, I agree.
Right. Well, in Alexander, this court said, and I was on the court, state asserts that not submitting the status element to the jury is a partial jury waiver. I'm reading from the case. The state argues that a defendant has no right to a trial by a judge alone, and therefore has no right to a trial only by a judge on one element. So the state's argument, as I understood it from the case, was they're entitled to a jury trial on this status element in Alexander. And the court said the state's argument is misplaced. This is not an issue of jury waiver. His admission dispenses with the need for proof of the status element either to a jury or a judge. And it seems to me that's inconsistent with the way this was treated in the Warbleton case. Seems to me in Warbleton, the judge is saying, you're waiving a jury trial, you apply the jury trial rules of waiver. And it seems to me that Alexander says, when the defendant wants to stipulate to an element, it's not waiver of a jury. And I don't see how you can make those two cases, at least as to that, consistent.
I would think applying the logic and rule of Alexander to Warbleton's case, the circuit court judge could have said, look, the way the Supreme Court has reconciled 97202 and the rules of evidence, the status element, even if we're going to concede it's a substantive element, this particular element is unique and the defendant can effectively...
I don't see how you get that under a jury trial waiver. It's nothing about waiving jury trial on status or not status. It's an element. Do you see what I'm driving at?
Right.
So it seems to me, to make these two consistent as the way they handled, you'd have to say that you didn't need a jury trial at all, and that what you should have gone to is discretion as to whether you put it in or not on what outweighs what, probative value versus prejudice. Or you say, Alexander's wrong. Alexander's wrong because when you the defendant wants to stipulate to an element, whatever the element is, it's a waiver of jury trial as to that element, and if the state objects, you put in the stipulation.
Well, I think that's correct. If you, in Alexander, for instance, if the jury is not informed whatsoever of the prior convictions, mm-hmm. you know, that element obviously
it's
has
gone.
Not been presented
yeah.
to the jury.
Yeah. And I'm having a hard time distinguishing the different kinds of prior convictions that you're trying to make. I mean, you're not asking us to overturn Alexander.
No,
you're just asking us
not.
To distinguish Alexander.
Yeah. Well, I think the Alexander rule is good. And I do see a difference between an element that would be a pre-existing legal status which predates the new conduct as opposed to any actions taken within that new period of conduct. In terms of the state's right to present its evidence and to present a full picture to the jury of what the defendant did, I see them as a very different kind, presenting evidence of a pre-existing conviction as opposed to, look, I'm entitled to present my evidence of what this defendant did.
How many convictions did he have in Alexander, do you remember?
I don't remember the exact number he had.
We talk about two or more, so I'm not sure it was always the same. Okay.
You're concerned about the danger of unfair prejudice.
Correct.
Does that apply, that concern apply in a civil case?
Well, I would think a concern about a jury being swayed by unfair prejudice would apply to a civil case.
Sexual predator case, for example?
I haven't given a great deal of thought to a sexual predator case, and I don't handle those, but my initial reaction would be anytime a fact finder could be swayed by unduly prejudicial evidence of little probative value, that's a legitimate concern.
Well, one of the elements of that situation, as I understand it, is number one, the defendant has been convicted of a sexually violent offense. It's hard to get around the fact that that's it's right there in front of the jury.
You're referring to a Chapter 980 commitment?
Yeah.
Well, in that instance, a citizen, you know, I guess my initial reaction would be no citizen could be committed under Chapter 980 unless they had that pre-existing conviction.
So is that more like OWI, or is it more like this case?
The Chapter 980?
Yeah, because it's a pre-existing conviction, so it sounds like the OWI case, right? You never get into sexual predator unless you have a prior conviction. You don't get into the OWI on .08 unless you have a prior offense.
Well, correct. You know, obviously, as the statutes stand now, the 0.02 level is quite low, and you're not subject to that prohibition unless you have...
No, so what is the sexual predator? Which case is it, like Alexander or Warpleton?
I have not given a great deal or any thought, I should say, to the Chapter 980 context, simply because I personally don't do those cases.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thomas J. Balistrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Balistrieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. Alexander is an extraordinary case.
Good, bad, or indifferent?
I'm sorry?
Good, bad, or indifferent?
Bad.
Bad. Just say yes.
Bad.
It's a side joke. Go ahead.
That wouldn't be
an extraordinary case for several reasons. First of all, it states a proposition that has not been generally accepted by courts in other states.
Which is the proposition?
The proposition that when prior conviction is an element of the crime, and the defendant is willing to stipulate to that element, you totally remove that element from the consideration of the jury. You don't even give them a stipulation. You don't allow them to determine that element at all on the basis of any kinds of evidence, whatever.
That's what the court said.
It says. And I've only been able to find three other courts that have adopted that same position. All in the context of repeat drunk driving cases, by the way. Every other case that I've found, including the United States Supreme Court in the Old Chief case, has decided that when a prior conviction is an element of a new offense, and the defendant is willing to stipulate, you give the jury the stipulation. You don't tell them what the prior crime is. You don't go into the details of that crime. But you do tell them that there is a stipulation that the defendant has been convicted of this prior crime, and you let the jury determine that element of the crime on the basis of that stipulation. That's one reason why Alexander is an extraordinary case. The second reason why Alexander is an extraordinary case is because of something that you were discussing when Mr. Lozat was arguing. And that is that in Alexander, you said you rejected,
Alexander, I didn't look.
Yeah.
Did you argue with Alexander?
I argued Alexander for the benefit of
the world. You want to win all.
No,
today.
Did you ask to get on this case?
I was told to get over here and clean up my mess. But anyway, in Alexander, I argued that the defendant would be giving up his right to a jury trial, and this court rejected that. You said he's not just giving up his right to a jury trial, he's giving up his right to a trial, period. Well, if he gives up his right to a jury trial, period, and he admits an element of the crime, that's a guilty plea. That is a partial guilty plea. So what this court did in Alexander was to create a procedure whereby a defendant is convicted on the basis of a jury trial and a guilty plea. That is extraordinary. I don't know of any other situation in which we have both a jury trial and a guilty plea resulting in a defendant's conviction. Now,
It may be an extraordinary holding, but isn't it fair to say that there is an extraordinary opportunity for unfair prejudice to the defendant in that circumstance? In other words, if in spite of his continued offers to admit to the priors, if the jury is informed about any number of prior convictions for drunk driving, isn't it fair to observe that the jurors are going to be tempted to use that as character or bad trait evidence?
Okay, I'm not re-arguing Alexander here. I'm not asking you to overrule it. I am accepting, for purposes of my argument today, that the court was correct
right.
in holding that...
Then let me modify the question.
In the drunk driving...
Yeah.
In the drunk driving context, where the jury is told, in essence, that the defendant has two prior convictions for drunk driving, at least two, that there's extraordinary prejudice. Okay, I'm accepting that for purposes of my argument.
All right, then that leads me to the next question. Is there not a risk of unfair prejudice in a stalking case of telling the jury, look, this defendant is not only a criminal, which could happen, they could find that out if he elects to take the stand.
Which he did in this case.
On impeachment. Whether he would have or wouldn't have, absent the jury knowing about that, is a question that no one knows the answer to, I suppose. But isn't there a risk of unfair prejudice by telling the jury about the violent nature of the prior conduct?
There is always a risk of prejudice in any case whenever the jury is told that the defendant has done something wrong in the past. But that doesn't mean we don't let the jury hear about it. There are many, many, many instances in which the jury is told of other acts evidence that is far more prejudicial than simply giving them a sanitized stipulation that the defendant has been convicted of a violent crime. Justice Prosser was alluding to Chapter 980 cases. We don't even have to go to 980 cases. We can go to sexual assault cases where there's a prosecution for sexual assault. And this court has held on a number of occasions that in those sexual assault cases, the jury may be told not only that the defendant has committed a prior sexual assault, but in some cases they can actually go into the details of the prior sexual assault. And that's fine, because while it has the potential for resulting in prejudice, it doesn't have the potential for substantial unfair prejudice. We say in those cases that the probative value of the evidence substantially outweighs any prejudice. In fact, we don't even have to go outside this case to see that as a proposition. Because there was, in addition to advising the jury in this case about the defendant's prior conviction, there was other acts evidence in this case of violent acts committed by this defendant against this victim. The jury was told about an incident where the defendant tried to run the victim off the road and threatened to kill her. They were told about an incident where the defendant put his fist through the victim's wall. They were told about an incident where the defendant threw the victim down on a table and tried to choke her. All that came in. That's far more prejudicial than...
Why did it come in? Other acts evidence?
Other acts evidence, yeah.
To prove what? The disposition to violence?
No, of course not.
What?
No, we can't do that. You know.
I lost my head for a minute.
Yeah, gee, come on.
That evidence was far more prejudicial, and yet, you know, what we say, and, you know, there are lots of cases that say this, that where you have this kind of a situation, that most of the prejudice can be dealt with by a jury instruction, just telling the jury, look, this evidence came in, but you only use it for this purpose, you can't use it to show that the defendant's a bad guy.
You know, one takeaway from Old Chief that is a possible interpretation, and it kind of dovetails into a question that Justice Ziegler had asked of your opposing counsel, is how does the nature of the offense itself, as promulgated by the legislature, fit in with the position that you now take, that the state now advances as to the propriety of the trial court's conduct or ruling here?
Well, we think the trial court was absolutely correct under Old Chief.
Right, but what I'd like to talk about is the fact of the element. We've been offered one possible scenario when something is a so-called substantive element,
okay,
as opposed to the legislature promulgating a law saying this is an element. And I'm curious to know what the state's position on that
is. Okay, well, our position is that this is an element.
Our position is, what I didn't hear that, is... I just didn't hear it. Our position is
that this is an element, that the prior conviction for a violent offense is an element of stalking. And we think that that's true, first of all, because I think we're all agreed that it's the legislature that determines whether something is an element of offense or whether it's a penalty enhancer. And therefore, in order to determine whether it's an element or a penalty enhancer, you engage in a process of statutory construction. Well, the first thing you do in the process of statutory construction is look at the plain language of the statute. And the plain language of this statute is that if a certain factor is present, the defendant is guilty of a crime. Now, that pretty plainly sounds to me like an element of defense. This is the situation. This is the fact in this case. Therefore, the defendant is guilty. It's not that this is a fact in this case, therefore the defendant can be sent to jail for a longer period of time than he otherwise might be. No, he's guilty. And when you say that he's guilty of a crime, if this, I won't use the word factor because that kind of begs the question, but if this particular situation is present, he's guilty of a crime, then that sounds like an element to me.
And so, Mr. Jerry, do you think that the courts have to draw distinctions between status elements and substantive elements?
No, absolutely not. An element is an element. We label it status, we label it historical fact for some purposes, but an element is an element. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what kind of element it is. It's something that the state has to prove in order to convict the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt.
Let me ask you another question here. My understanding of what occurred here was that everybody agreed to the stipulation, and the defendant agreed to a partial waiver of jury trial. The state didn't agree to the partial waiver. Would it make any difference? And let's say that the state did agree. Wouldn't the court still have to submit this question to the jury?
Well, not if there was a jury waiver, but the trial court and the parties in this case were incorrect under Alexander in treating this as a jury waiver.
And you'd handle Alexander, as I understand,
yes,
by saying it's a case that has to do with OWI.
Right.
Period.
Right.
But then you'd have to really look at the language in Alexander. There's some sentences in there that make it, that are absolutes, not limited to the facts. There are sentences in this that I read to you that say that it's not a jury issue. It's not a waiver.
It's not a jury waiver issue.
Yeah, it's not a jury waiver. Because you made that argument.
I made the argument that this...
I should have looked at who counsel was, but I didn't. But that was the exact waiver argument you made. I mean, that's right in the opinion, and the court said no. So that's my problem with the two cases. The way the Warbleton was handled below, it's a jury waiver. This is, no, it's not a jury waiver. That language can't stand, seems to me, in Alexander.
Well, I think it was wrong. I know.
You're not arguing. Take it away. What do we do about that language? We just say it's limited to the facts of this case, of Alexander. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's all I'm asking you to do in this case.
All right.
Because that's all I need for you to do in order to win this case.
Comes the next case, we'll take it another step.
And that's coming up.
Is it really?
Yes. There's another case pending in the Court of Appeals that's awaiting the disposition of this case.
What's the name of the case?
I don't recall. Sorry to say, I don't recall.
You're telling us.
I'm sorry?
Never mind, I'm teasing you. I said you're not telling us. I'll look it up.
I'm telling you I'll look it up and send you away.
Can we go back to the question I had earlier?
Sorry.
And basically, it's does it really make any difference whether the state agrees to the waiver, the partial waiver of jury trial or not? We've got language in several cases that would seem to say that even where you've got a partial waiver of a jury trial, you still submit that stipulation to the jury, as the court did here. Do you think that's right or wrong?
I think it's wrong.
Okay. Why?
Because if in fact you could have a partial waiver of a jury trial, it would depend, and this gets into a real mucky mess, you know. But it would depend, I think, on precisely what the parties waived. If the parties were to specifically waive a jury trial and were to expressly agree that the court could determine an element of the offense, just like the court determines a penalty enhancer, then I don't think you would submit that to the jury if that were the stipulation. If the stipulation were, this doesn't go to the jury, the court can decide it, then it just goes to the court. But if you didn't have the second part of the stipulation, where the court makes the decision, then you might have to submit it to the jury regardless of whether there's a jury waiver.
So the lack of consent by the state here is important.
Right.
Well, it isn't important in this particular case under Alexander because
I know
we're not waiving a jury trial.
But putting Alexander in its own little box now.
Yeah. Putting Alexander in its box, the fact that the state declined to waive a jury would be important because the state does have a right to a jury trial, just as the defendant has a right to a jury trial, and no waiver by the state, no waiver of the jury.
Has there ever been any argument made that maybe the statute is unconstitutional as drafted?
I'm not aware of any.
That's not an issue, the constitutionality of the statute.
That's not an issue in this case.
The major statute that we're dealing with, the enhancement, element. In many ways, the train has left the station, as you point out, with regard to some cases on other acts, evidence, and that frame, that give frame and context to our jurisprudence on this issue. I'm going to, having said that as a preference, if you ask these students, right, and we're not asking them because this is our job, ask these students, you have someone who's charged with a stalking offense. And I think, ooh, stalking, ooh, I see some of these movies and stalking, and I mean, ooh, it's kind of spooky. And then you have, by the way, this person is, I want you to know that this person has been convicted of a prior violent felony. That certainly is prejudicial.
Has the potential for prejudice.
No, I think it is prejudicial. The question is whether or not it's unfairly prejudicial, in the words of the statute, the probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. But I think ipso facto it's prejudicial. Well, maybe I'm wrong on that. You know, maybe what constitutes unfair prejudice is just fine line drawing as viewed by seven sets of eyes in a particular time. But it's a great concern to me because I think that it is. I think that it is prejudicial, and I think that at times, depending on the facts of the case, that it can be unfairly prejudicial.
As I said before, any evidence of other bad acts always has the potential for prejudice.
And it seems to me that maybe in certain kinds of cases, that whatever the status element is, versus substantive element, but certainly it's relevant. You know, if it's an element, it's relevant. You can't tell me it's not relevant. But perhaps
I'm going to try to tell you.
I know, but perhaps the probative value in certain types of cases, with regard to status element, is less, and the unfair prejudice of this kind of testimony rises. You know, every case is different. And so it seems to me that maybe the status element versus substantial substantive element might make a difference. Do you think so?
Yeah, but there are two things that help to assuage any prejudice. One is that the jury, when there's a stipulation, the jury is never told about the nature of the crime. And it's the nature of the crime.
Violent.
That's very prejudicial. That's the basis of the holding in Alexander. It's that the jury was, in essence, told that the defendant had at least two prior drunk driving convictions, the very crime for which he was on trial. Here, they're not told. They're not told what the prior offense was.
Violence, though, that means...
Yeah, violence, but...
No, that's different. Have you ever been convicted of a crime? I'm not talking about that kind of question.
But violent criminal... There are all kinds of violent crimes. People who commit violent crimes don't necessarily stalk. People who drink and drive tend to drink and drive again. people who commit violent crimes don't necessarily commit crimes of stalking. So that's one big difference. The other thing is, under the jurisprudence of this court, and as you say, the train has left the station a long time ago, it's gone down the track, we can deal with prejudice. We can deal with the potential of prejudice by jury instructions, which the jury is presumed to follow.
Well, you don't give a jury instruction in this case. You don't say, well, he committed a violent crime, but don't hold that against him. Only do it for plan, motive, intent, whatever.
Well, actually, the jury was pretty much instructed that way in this case.
Well, how can you instruct on an element of a crime to ignore it? I mean, what kind of...
Well, here, all right, in this case...
What is this?
In this case, it was treated as an element. The stipulation was submitted to the jury, and the jury was expressly instructed that they should not consider the fact that he had been convicted of a violent crime to conclude that he committed the crime of stalking for which he was being tried. There was a very explicit instruction to that effect.
But then why are they told it? Because the statute says...
Statute says it's an element.
That
the jury has to
find it. Now.
I'm sorry?
If that was the instruction, it sounds like a penalty enhancement to me.
And this really sharpens up my question, the basis for my question. Is the bright line rule that the state is advancing here, if it is an element, it comes in absent a stipulation, a waiver by both parties?
There's no question that this is an element of the crime, and there's
no
stipulation.
I know that, and you've answered that before. But, and you said that, and your answer has been consistent all along. I understand that the state's position is it's an element. But I want to take it one step further. The bright line rule that the state is advancing seems to me, and I'm just asking whether it's true or not,
okay,
is that if, because this is an element of the crime, it comes in absent a stipulation by both parties.
That's correct. That is our position.
And that any danger of unfair prejudice may be remediated by a cautionary instruction such as was given in the present case.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
If it's an element of a crime, then, that has special treatment. In other words, the general statute with regard to 90403, the Balancing Act, that deals with generally relevant evidence. Element is obviously relevant evidence. But you don't think that an element should be subject to exclusion under a 90403 test. Am I right or wrong? Do you think an element like this should be subject to a 90403 test?
Well, any evidence is subject to the balancing test.
Even if it's an element?
Sure.
And so, following up Justice Gableman's question, the bright line rule isn't quite so bright line because you always have 90403.
Yeah, but I will turn up the lights by saying that when evidence establishes an element of the crime, and it's the only evidence that establishes an element of the crime, it comes in because, as a matter of law, the probative value outweighs the prejudicial effect.
Okay. Has to.
Yes, it has to.
If he hadn't stipulated, what kind of evidence could the state put in showing the violent crime? The conviction, all the facts of the conviction, all the facts underlying the conviction, the transcript of the trial, his guilty plea?
No, I think under the balancing test, I think they would not have been able to put in everything. But they would have put in the fact that he was convicted and the nature of the offense and the fact that under the statute which defines violent crimes, this was a violent crime. So if he had not stipulated that, the jury would have learned the nature of the crime, they would have learned that he had been previously convicted of a sexual assault.
Of a child.
Yeah.
Could the element have been satisfied by simply the defendant was convicted of a crime as defined in 939.632.1E1?
That's basically what they were told. Well,
they had to be told what that section in the chapter was.
Well, but it was the word violent.
Violent.
Yeah.
I think they had to be told that it was a violent crime, because otherwise, how could the jury have determined the element, which is that he had a violent crime, unless they were told that he stipulated that he had a violent crime? So I think the word violent had to come in. Thank you. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your attention.
Well, tell me, I'm sorry, Mr. Ballesteros, so how should this opinion be written, other than affirm?
You can follow my brief, that would be...
Why don't you summarize it for us?
Just read your lips.
We'll read your lips, right.
Okay, first of all, this is an element of the crime. Basically because the plain language of the statute indicates that it's an element. Plus the other argument, I think, that's very convincing that this is an element is that the way the statute reads, if any of the following are present, and then there's a whole bunch of subsections, and some of them, as Justice Prosser was indicating, are plainly historical facts, including the use of a dangerous weapon, which the Court of Appeals has already said is an element of the crime. And all of these are treated the same. If any of them are present, the defendant is guilty of a Class H felony. There is absolutely no reason to treat any of the factors that are listed any differently, given that lead language, that if any of these are present, including things that we are all agreed are elements of an offense, if any of them are present, the defendant is guilty of an aggravated version of the crime. There's no reason to treat any one of those differently. So this is clearly an element. Then we get to the question of Alexander. Alexander should be limited to its facts because it is an unusual case that has unusual effects, and it was based on an unusual situation.
Any language to be withdrawn or explained?
For purposes of this case, I don't think you need to do that. I don't think you need. You certainly can if you feel that it would be appropriate, but for purposes of this case, I don't think you need to withdraw anything or change anything. So all you need to do is say, we hold Alexander to its facts. That's what I'm asking you to do. Because it's an extraordinary case. Other courts have not gone that way. You've created this strange situation where you have a jury trial and a guilty plea combined to determine whether the defendant is guilty, plus Alexander was based on the very unusual factual situation where the defendant, where the jury was essentially told that the defendant had been convicted not just once, but at least twice of the same offense for which he was on trial, and that I think that people are more inclined to believe that someone who drives while drunk once, twice, is inclined to do it the third time. So for those reasons, what we're asking the court to do in this case is not necessarily to overrule the 7-0 decision in Alexander, but to restrict it to the particular facts of that case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And you're going to send us the Court of Appeals decision?
Yes.
Pending case. Thank you. You will send a copy to opposing counsel.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Counsel?
With respect to the Alexander decision, the state said that in that particular case, the jury was told that the defendant had at least 2 prior convictions for drunk driving. It was actually a lot less jarring than that. The jury was told that
the defendant had two or more prior convictions, suspensions, or revocations under Section 343.307. So if they came to the conclusion that he had prior convictions for drunk driving, that was them drawing an inference from the instruction they were given.
Counsel, I need to follow up on my first question I asked you, and I think I follow your logic. It is, if the crime without violent crime is a crime in and of itself, then you don't need to tell the jury about the violent crime. It doesn't become an element because the conviction should be based on stalking. Because stalking is a crime whether or not you have someone who's previously convicted. Right? Felon in possession of a firearm is not a crime unless you tell the jury about the person having a felony conviction. Right?
Right.
All right. Then I started thinking, well, what other crimes are like that? And what other scenarios would this affect? And I thought of the 981, but then I started looking at the statutes. Battery. Battery is a crime. Battery is a crime as a misdemeanor. And the elements remain basically the same. But then you have aggravated battery. But then you turn into, like, 940.20, battery by a prisoner. And then one of the elements is the person confined in a prison? And are they battering another inmate or someone who works in a prison? I mean, your logic would affect that dramatically, too. All of a sudden that statute is either inapplicable or can't be charged or unenforceable, or those felonies are proven by proving up a misdemeanor, or how do you envision that working?
The difference I would see with battery by a prisoner is that's part of why the conduct is egregious. At the time the battery occurs, that defendant is incarcerated.
Right, but under your logic, for someone to know someone was previously convicted of a crime, if they're actually in prison at that point, don't you think that impacts the jury's decision as well?
Well, in that particular circumstance, you know, they would inevitably know it. You know, for instance, if an inmate was on trial for first-degree intentional homicide of another inmate, just presenting the facts of what occurred would lead the jury to know that the defendant was a state prisoner.
Well, I'm just trying to carry your logic to its next conclusion, because the next case will come down the line, and all of a sudden that's not an element of the offense because battery can be otherwise proven. Or homicide is just, it's a homicide of an inmate. All of a sudden you don't tell the jury about them being inmates, right? You just try it as if it's a homicide. You pretend the case isn't what it really is. I'm trying to get...
Yeah, I would disagree, because in that instance, if a DA was proving a homicide, he needs to present to the jury the whole circumstances in which it occurred. It doesn't relate to, I want to present evidence of a prior conviction. It's like, no, I want to tell the jury what occurred, the crime that occurred. They need to know all the circumstances. They need to have the narrative richness. And I don't think that applies with proving a prior conviction.
Okay. So the fact that a person is a prisoner and commits battery to a visitor wouldn't be, that's not prejudicial such that it should be taken away from the jury.
It's prejudicial, but I do see those as elements. That's part of the crime, is the particular person you battered in the particular place you were in when you committed the battery. It relates to what occurred during the crime. The actions undertaken, your status as the perpetrator, the victim's status at the time.
Okay, but the status of the person here is the status of a person who has been convicted of a violent crime. And that's an element, as I see it.
With respect to presenting to the jury, though, what occurred between June 1st, 2003 and May 9th, 2005, for the jury to fulfill its role of deciding what happened in that time frame, it didn't assist them at all to know that he had a 1995 criminal conviction.
Okay.
The state also said that, as far as it knows, there's no other case like Alexander, and I would just refer the court to page 9, paragraph 3 of the state's brief. It cites State versus Nichols, a West Virginia case, which in part has a sentence, if a defendant makes an offer to stipulate to a prior conviction, that is a status element of an offense. The trial court must permit such stipulation and preclude the state from presenting any evidence to the jury regarding the stipulated prior conviction. So Alexander is not unusual with respect to that West Virginia case. And also the state cites State versus Murray, a Hawaii case, And the court there, in addressing what would occur on remand, requires the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the element that defendant has had at least two prior misdemeanor convictions, the last of which occurred within 2 years of the charged offense, without indicating that the two prior convictions must be for abuse of a household or family member. So in this case, with respect to an earlier question by Justice Prosser, if it was going to go to the jury, I think a permissible stipulation would be that this defendant has a qualifying prior conviction. You could just present them with a statute number. You would not have to go into, you would not have to tell them it's a violent felony. And neither do I think it's that altogether unusual to have a partial waiver of a jury trial. In the Wisconsin jury instructions, special materials 21, at page 4, paragraph C addresses partial jury trial waiver. So in this particular instance, the state was free to stipulate that the state obviously considers the prior conviction an element. The state had the ability to stipulate that that would be tried to the court, and the court alone would not be presented to the jury. It was obvious in this case that the state wanted the jury to hear that Mr. Warbleton had a previous conviction for a violent crime. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for their arguments today relating to a number of issues the court keeps getting: jury trial, other crimes evidence, curative instructions, and now a review of the Alexander case. So thank you both, counsel, for that. 07AP105CR State versus Warbleton. The hearing is now closed. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. I will meet with whoever wishes to meet with me immediately. We are in recess until tomorrow morning for our third set of cases for the November sitting.